to House Bill 5015. What do you want to explain what we're looking at?
Chair Hill, members of the subcommittee, or committee, we're here today to talk about the Employment Department and their IT projects and initiatives. Just real briefly, the Employment Department is responsible for managing the unemployment insurance tax system, for analyzing and providing employment data to employers, job seekers, and policymakers. They're also responsible for regulating the childcare system, and they also provide some hearing services for a variety of state agencies. In terms of budget, the Employment Department has four policy packages in their governor's recommended budget, which all incorporate a little piece of some IT projects. And I believe they'll be talking about those today, as well as a lot of the widespread projects and activities they have. In terms of big ticket, brand new type initiatives, they don't have any big packages in their budget, but they have a lot of ongoing activities, including a lot of website and internal database and development type work. And with that, back over to you, Chair Hill.
Thank you. Lynn, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Berlina Cosley, and I am the director for the Oregon Employment Department. And I have Kurt Amo, who is our acting chief information officer. We have in your book information that we hope you will find helpful, and obviously we will try to answer any questions that you have along the way. I'd like to give you just a brief overview of what's in your packet. We do, on the left-hand side, have our strategic plan, and then we also have a highlight update of the plan itself, so you can see that our business really does drive our IT initiatives rather than vice versa. On page, that's tab one, and page three, I would like to go over our guiding principles for our technology decisions. Ms. Byerly talked about our business. Our mission actually is to promote employment and develop the workforce, support the unemployed, promote safe, quality child care, and conduct impartial and timely hearings. But our principles in trying to serve our customers is that we do try to focus on customer service. I would say if you had to look at our primary customers, those tend to be businesses and job seekers. We in our agency and in our strategic plan would indicate that business is our number one customer. They are the paying customer. They pay 97% of our budget through unemployment insurance taxes. Then we also believe that business should drive technology, and we have individuals who are very technically proficient and want to use computers, probably to a great degree, don't want to come into our offices at all, and others that can't use computers primarily because of maybe language barriers or disabilities or other kinds of disabilities. Partnership opportunities. We tend to want to be and are a huge partnership agency in that we work with the social service agencies, we work with economic development, excuse me, and those are at the business levels in the private sector, as well as across the public sector at the state level and at the local level. We also try to keep our staff trained. I think that probably one of the things that you should know is about 5 years ago, when a lot of Y2K work was starting or was being scoped out, the Employment Department, like many agencies, were losing a lot of our staff, or we were having a difficulty in recruiting. And that has really stopped for the most part. We really hear from our staff that they appreciate us trying to keep them trained on new technology. And they also get to work on maintenance, but they get to do innovative projects in sort of real time. And that is a thing that they really like to do. And we also have innovative, stable, and sustainable solutions. We try to incrementally work on things so they aren't so big that the project, when it fails, that it is costly for the state, that it is a big learning experience. We try to take the project and put it into smaller pieces that overall fit a strategy that could stand alone, but also if it failed, would not be such a big failure. On page 4, continuing on with our strategy, in our budget, the upcoming budget, and frankly our current budget, we have invested in what is generally referred to as a clicks and bricks strategy. The Gardner Group, when they look at having businesses that are just total technology or totally brick and mortar, like a corner store or in our case would be a field office, that any one of those standing alone would be more likely to fail and not be able to provide service to the customers in an adequate way. And they promote, and I agree, that you should have a combination strategy that looks at the proper balance of those services that you should provide through technology that would improve access and customer satisfaction. But you also need staff that will be able to follow up. If you have, for example, email, then there needs to be a reasonable expectation of how fast people can get their emails answered. Or if they list their job order, that it will not just stand out there with nobody looking at it and helping to service that. We also, as I indicated, we work in collaboration with our federal agency partners. This happens to be a region that we work with Idaho and Washington and Alaska a lot on our strategies. And again, as I said, it's the state and local areas. And we'll talk a little bit about a business portal that we've been working on with state agencies in the state of Oregon. On page 5, I'm going to have Kurt talk to you about our current environment, but generally even before Kurt joined our agency, and he came to us from the Department of Transportation, but before he joined us, we had what we call a three-prong strategy. We use a combination of mainframe, client server, and remote access, and we've been doing this for quite some time, so within our agency and our service delivery, they tend to be pretty proven strategies in meeting our customers' needs. And with that, I will let Kurt talk about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Amel. I'm the Acting Chief Information Officer for the Employment Department. I think the intent on slide 5, on page 5, is to try to give you an indication that we have a complex and interrelated platform on which we deliver our services to the customer. We have hundreds of programs running on our mainframe that group into 77 legacy systems. We use the hosting services that are available through DHS and DAS to run that. We do not have our own mainframe. We have a series of local area and wide area networks connecting our 46 field offices with our central office, providing services directly to the public for benefits, job services through our career centers, and a variety of other services. We have over 2,300 workstations and laptops located throughout the state, all connected with that network. Again, many of those directly dedicated to providing services and access to the public. A key component of our strategy, Director Franklin referred to clicks and bricks aspect of our strategy, is our remote access technology. There's three subcomponents of that. We're on page 5 of our book.
I just had a question. I went back to your mainframe piece because you're whizzing by it, but your documentation says you have 77 different systems running.
Mm-hmm. Subsystems, yes.
Legacy subsystems?
That's correct.
What is that equipment for government applications? Are there 77 distinct applications running on these mainframes?
They're generally grouped into our unemployment insurance systems. There's a description of them on page 24 in behind tab 6. But typically, our automated tax system, known as OATS, our benefit information system, which we call OBIS, and our wage system and our job selection service system are the four main areas that those are grouped into. So these are COBOL applications with GIPS screens sharing data on vSAN files.
Okay,
And how often are you having to change these systems? I mean, aren't they fairly, I mean, they've been in place a long time, the legacy systems have been in place a long time. You don't have a lot of the, as many of the federal changes as you probably, as probably DHS or someone like that does. I'm just wondering how often you're changing them.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pattridge, actually, we do change them quite a bit. There are federal changes, but each legislature, depending on legislation that passes, we do. We had a big one, House Bill 3141, which actually had us change 4,000 of our 6,000 lines of code last session when we looked at whether a company could take their, if they broke off into and new companies, they could take their old rate, their unemployment rate, to their new company if it was a good one. And that, things like that cause quite a bit of rewrite. But generally speaking, you're right, they are fairly stable. Most of them, however, have been rewritten in the 1990s. We did actually have a contract, a fairly large contract, to move some of those off to client server about 1994, 95, something like that. And it was not successful, but the state had not put very much money in it, but they couldn't bring it up real time because of the amount of data that is processed and has to be processed very quickly.
Senator Duncan?
Did you want to respond something first?
No, please.
You know, when we went to page 24, something caught my eye, and I don't have time to right now, but I mentioned it. I was looking at the interactive voice response. And, Mr. Chair, I was just kind of curious about that. And would it be better to wait, or is that appropriate at this particular point to ask a question about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, we will be describing our interactive voice response system, or our IVR systems, in a few minutes.
Okay, why don't I wait?
And, okay, I'll be happy to address
sure,
your questions when they come up. Down to our remote access approach, we feel that this is a strategy that does support several of our e-government initiatives. We have an internet environment that consists of over 1,000 web pages. Most of those are available in both Spanish and English. They're all linked to DAZ's Oregon online website. They provide information to job seekers, employers, the Child Care Commission, and also regional labor market information. Another key aspect of our remote access technology is our kiosks. These are touch screen devices that do not require a keyboard or a mouse to access the information. They're distributed throughout the state. There's over 150 of them in locations typically designed to provide access to our services and information for that group of the population that doesn't have immediate access to the internet or to our field offices. Our interactive voice response system is a set of systems that provide access and ability for individuals to renew their continued claims, to get access on the status of various hearings. That's a system that is distributed throughout the state. Over 80% of the calls on our IVR system come in through local call numbers. And it's, I think we renew up to 95% of our claims actually come in through the RDR system. Now, maybe this might be a good time to address any question you may.
Well, Mr. Chair, I might ask, and with due respect to my colleagues who serve on another committee with me, you'll hear a kind of familiar question I ask. I understand the I guess my concern, as I'm asking all state agencies with which I come into contact, is there access to a personal touch? I'm just curious if you're in someplace, can you get a hold of someone at the client? Can you get a person? Are you always going to be at a number sending you someplace else? I just was curious what. In fact, I've even asked other people, and I've asked the same thing. Have you tried to get into your agency? Not usually in the access code numbers that you know of yourself, that you can get that to, but if you were a person living in Burns or someplace else, and you really have a pressing problem and you're not getting the information you need on any machine out here or with these apps or anything like that, can you get through to somebody and get a person?
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, the answer is supposed to be yes. In that we do have staff, and right before you came in, I was talking about a combination strategy that we have that we call clicks and bricks, which we do believe that you cannot just serve the people with just technology and interactive voice responses. That each one of our offices has been instructed to answer the phone, and they also will see you face to face. We have 46, 47 locations where people can come in. And that's been a conscious discussion with the legislature to keep those offices open in, you know, small areas where we may have only 2 to 3 people, for example. I do, as a director, call numbers, and if I hit 0 twice, they get a call from me personally. That means that it has tumbled from one number, and that might mean that they are on the phone, and then it's supposed to go to another number. If I hit the number twice, they answer the telephone call. And I will tell you that does happen. That's why I said it is supposed to be that they can get through to a person. Now, sometimes that is because they are really overloaded. And sometimes it is maybe because they just want to get some other work done besides, you know, and so they are trying to do the best, I think, given their limited hours as well. But yes, in the employment department you should be, and if you do have problems with that, I would hope that you would bring that to my attention.
Sure, I just so people know that I think what triggered my is when I was trying to get through the agency, I'm just kind of a bit perseverant, and I wanted to test something, I guess. It took me 45 minutes to get a nurse, and I just started with it. And it's amazing the number of times I got, I'm away from my desk, I just started bringing it back. And I was also thinking, if I were a person out there having to put 35 cents into a coin phone, which many people have to do on the telephone, yeah, it would be very difficult. I mean, I'm sitting in my home just saying, okay, I'm going to stick with this till I get some. So I've been asking that question.
No, I think it's a very good question, and it's one that, frankly, I think as an agency we need to continue to push on that, because it is very easy to forget that that's part of our service delivery as well. The other thing I should tell you, though, that on the interactive voice response, we went to it primarily to expand hours and access on the weekends without having to have a lot of staff. And the majority of our calls do come in on weekend, because your new week starts on the Monday. So they are, you know, telling us that they are still unemployed and all the questions that you have to go through. So those are big times that we wouldn't be accessible, you know, per se, by with person. But generally speaking, during the week, you should be able to get a person. And I hope you bring it to my attention if you have problems.
And by the way, as I say, people call my office.
Oh, yeah.
I know, we might get tested because I'm supposed to be that.
Well, are you using the IVR system to front-end access to people versus making up the claim?
Mr. Chair, we have not yet. That is our desire, and we actually put in for a grant, which we did get, for telephone claims. We asked, actually, for internet and telephone. We got funded the telephone one, and the legislature has approved that. It's a 3-year grant that we're looking at the scope of the project, et cetera, and then we've been instructed back to the JLCIMT should we move forward with that. But that is our plan to do.
I guess I'm trying to understand. So what are you doing today at the IVR?
Each week a person has to answer certain questions in which to be able to continue their claim. To open their claim the first time, initial time, they either drop that by, mail it in, or come in person.
I understand that.
Okay.
But my question is, are you using the IVR system at the front end getting access to employment division staff? If I want to talk to a person, do I have to go through an IVR system?
Oh, no.
Or a phone call?
Oh, no. I understand the question.
IVR is
the answer is no, you do not have to.
Okay. So the IVR is the claims. So what is the grant? How's that different?
I'm sorry.
The
grant actually would allow individuals to file their initial claim over the interactive voice response instead of coming in, should they want to, but we will still have access at a field office level if they want to do that in person.
Mr. Members of the Committee, on turning the page to page six is a schematic, basically the same thought. Our network is behind a firewall. We're trying to indicate there the connection with a variety of services that are provided. We have our internet just recently received 6.1 million hits for the month of February, which is an all-time high for us. It was 5.5 million hits in January. Our kiosks continue to be a popular service delivery item, and we're just trying to indicate that the services that our systems provide to the public are connected and share a lot of data and transmission between each other.
Where are these systems located? Do you have your own data center, or are you in the data center?
Most of our file and print servers are located at the field offices and in the area. We have a number of servers at our central office headquarters. We host our mainframe applications on the DHS mainframe, and we also actually host some applications on the DAS mainframe.
Where's the web server?
Our web server is at the central field office, central office here in Salem. Our web environment is actually hosted with three servers, and they're right here in Salem.
Is there any, it's just content? Is there any interactivity?
We receive job postings off of our mainframe system, transmit that data to one of the web servers. People in the public can look up the status of those jobs. They can actually register and pass secure information back to our databases, including their social security number. All of that we want to keep secure and confidential. So those servers are transmitting and passing live dynamic data back and forth to our legacy system.
And then that legacy system downloads every 2 hours on the jobs. So they're seeing something that's about 2 hours old, the actual public, but it is also out of our legacy system that's downloaded.
So it wouldn't be any difficult to move into the DAS data center?
We would be, technically, we would want to investigate areas of service delivery, make sure we would be able to continue to be as responsive as we currently are.
What does that mean?
When changes are needed to our environment, we can quickly adapt and adjust those changes because we have direct access to the machines. So that would be an important component to us. So in wanting to evaluate that, we would look at three basic areas: customer service level. We'd want to be able to continue to provide that. We'd like to be able to ensure that the cost of the agency would not any movement of equipment like that would not incur a greater cost to the agency. And those would be the main areas that we would look at.
And Mr. Chair, I need to say that when Dan Mazziotti was here, I did personally contact him, and he indicated they were not ready to take on anything of our size at this point in time. If that has changed, I'd be more than glad to talk to them.
What is the brand, what model, the Sun Service are you running?
We have one Sun Server 5000 and a Sun Server 3000. The rest of our servers are Dell machines.
So you said I'm just referring to the web services. You said you had three machines?
Yeah, those are Dell 2400 in that neighborhood.
So all fits in a rack?
Yes.
So if DAS has a rack, power, and a firewall, then I mean, if you're already making connections to the TAS mainframe and to DHS mainframe where it sits in the report, you've already bridged the gap of how to integrate back to back end legacy systems remotely, correct?
That's correct. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also, we actually are interested in this concept of central hosting. We've contributed, as a matter of fact, one of our systems to the DAS IRMD group in order to track legislative items that move forward, and do agree that there might be opportunities for that, and certainly are willing to look at that.
Can you identify in terms of what FTE is used to maintain the web service? I'm not talking content, I'm talking administration.
We will come to our, we have a slide on coming up that identifies our staffing areas, and they're broken out. We tried to provide that information to you here in just a minute.
You have it.
Yes. We have, Mr. Chair, we have six FTEs that provide our network support for the agency.
Are they doing other things other than maintaining the website?
Yes.
So if you could identify what FTE operates for you, web server. This is not content, not responsible for moving content or managing content, but in terms of operation of the server.
We'll come back with that information.
Thank you.
I think on page 7, you can see just a visual of the kinds of things that we look at when we look at tiers, types of services to the public, to our partners, and then internally, the employment department. These aren't totally per se standalone, if you will, but they are. Mission critical services to the public would include, things like the unemployment insurance check, and then we tried to graphically say whether or not we're using the mainframe client server or remote access on some of those kinds of things. In your booklet behind tab 6, you would be able to see all the things that we use that are in tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3.
Are you, when you're doing unemployment benefits, are you doing direct deposit?
We are.
Your percentage?
Do you have that?
Direct deposit on unemployment benefits versus checks.
We have that, and I'm just trying to look at it very, very quickly. But yes, we've had that quite some time.
Mr. Chair, I'm reading from page 25. In the year 2000, we delivered 81,718 direct deposits. We also printed over 2 million checks on that day in that time frame.
How do we move to reduce the number of checks? I'm assuming your checks are more expensive than your direct deposit.
Actually, we encourage that. We sometimes put little stickers in some of those kinds of things, but at this point, that's really on. On page 8, these are a listing of our data processing equipment, some of the ones that Stuart has already talked to you about, our desktop PCs, our Dell Pentium 3s, and they run on Windows NT and Microsoft Office Suite. Our printers are Lexmark. We have a little over 2,000 desktops and about 178 laptops. We have the servers that Stuart talked about and our database servers as well. Then in our replacement cycles, I know you've talked about replacement strategies for agencies, and in the 01-03 biennium, we have what we call our what is inter?
IT replacement.
IT replacement plan, I move to call it ITRP, and I was trying to forget, remember what that acronym was. But anyway, you can see that we have a four-year replacement cycle. Sometimes if we get additional dollars, like we did with the Y2K, we made that part of our Y2K strategy to do some replacement at that time. But generally speaking, we're on a four-year replacement cycle. Laptops between 2 and 4 years, printers 5 years, and file print servers 3 years. On 1-800 numbers, we have 34.
So how many PCs are you going to replace this?
1,119.
In the upcoming biennium.
In the upcoming biennium, that's what we're planning.
Do you, how are you procuring this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we purchase the Dell, we purchase this equipment off the state purchase agreement.
So are you purchasing off of the Western State purchasing agreement, or are you doing, I mean, there's different lists.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that we received the pricing of the Western State's agreement, the Western prices.
Okay. Software, are you procuring off of the contracts that State has with ASAP software with Microsoft in terms of where it's the yearly charge for all applications?
That's my understanding also. Yes.
Representative Patrick.
I just want to make sure I have my figures right. In the 0103 on page 8, is that how many you anticipate you're going to replace?
Correct.
But then I look ahead to your agency staffing,
mm-hmm.
and your agency staffing is 1,492. So you're replacing everyone's desktop this year?
We have
basically?
Short of 300.
Well, no, but I'm, well,
we
all but 200, basically.
I'm sorry?
Well, I mean, it looks like you're replacing, if every agency staff has one desktop, you're basically replacing every single desktop this year except absent maybe 200.
We actually have many PCs in our lobby for the public, and the public comes in and uses them. So we have a lot in the public, too. I don't know if you have a breakout for how many the PCs are for staff versus the public, but do you?
I don't have that, Mr. Chair, Representative Passage. I don't have the exact numbers with me at the moment. We can certainly provide those to you, but the intent in our replacement plan for 0103 is, in fact, to replace approximately one half of our desktop platform, and we will replace the second half moving on in a four-year cycle. We're planning to do that in 0305.
Can you tell me how many PCs you have?
We have 2,300 PCs and laptops throughout the state.
May I ask a question, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. I noticed that the ratio of laptops to printers is different in each of the departments. Is there a standard policy that you have on that?
We typically have 1-4, but it depends on the uh-huh. type of work that you have. In our adjudicator section, where they have a lot of paper
mm-hmm.
Because they're writing decisions, they have more printers because they get backed up.
Yeah.
But generally, it's a 1-4 ratio.
And one other question, if I could, Mr. Chairman, at page 8, I noticed that you're computing part of your budget based upon the 13 cents a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I thought DAS was telling us that that's going to go down to 6 cents a minute.
These are 800 rates, which are different.
Oh, 800 rates are different. Okay. But your telephone budget and your total budget is reflects that difference.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, I don't have the number with me right now, but there will be an adjustment in the recommended budget to reflect the reduced rate.
Oh, good. I was just looking for some savings there that
yeah.
you could apply to some other things.
It started to apply that now, so we're going to go back to the other agencies that wasn't applied to, and they will start grabbing the savings off of the anticipated savings on the reduction of long distance rates.
Any idea on how much that's going to be?
It's a lot of money.
Can I have some of it? Programs.
I would invite, if you actually wanted to see a field office, the Salem field office is very, very close. It's only a few blocks down. and you could see what the staff had, and you can also see what the public has. The public uses those for resume writing, they use them for internet connections with jobs, a number of those things, but since Representative Patrick has talked about the number of staff we have, the other portion of those would be in the public places.
Mr. Chair, I have been in the Oregon City Field Office, and it's pretty information technology intensive there, so I think they do a pretty good job.
Thank you.
On the 800 lines, let's see, it's ready to attach it back here. Tab 8, right? Is there a reason why we have so many 800 lines versus getting local numbers in local communities and bringing it back on the state network?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually, in relation to our IVR system, for example, we do have the majority of those access numbers are through local call numbers at no charge to the citizen, nor at the charge to the agency. Overall, and we do have, as you see on behind tab 8, over 3,800 numbers, and the intent there is to provide access for a variety of citizens who are outside local calling jurisdictions for information and for services and benefits.
We can actually break them down even more so you can see how much is used for particular services like surveys, for example, for calling back on surveys. We actually used to have some of them more combined for a central location, but we were finding that very difficult because the calls that we get tend to be very specific in nature, and we were having to transfer the person or actually call them back a lot depending on what they were calling for. Many of them, as you can see, have to do with our adjudication centers. We have 9 adjudication centers, and that's where staff is getting information from both business and the public on information related to a claim. Then there are some that we use for dial-up connections, for research, as I said, surveys, and child care commissions.
So I'm going to sit there and I'm going to talk about calling Medford.
Mm-hmm.
So are you publishing the local number? Are you publishing the 800 number for someone? So I'm just, so I if someone's in Medford, calling the Medford adjudication center, it's be less expensive to the state if they use the local number versus the 800 number. Have you employed the service?
About 80%, Mr. Chair, used the local numbers, and about 20% used the state number. We did look at that.
Okay.
So, and we do publish the local numbers. Now, we do interstate claims, as you know. So if they have vacated a job in, say, Medford and move out of state, they will sometimes call the interstate number, and something depending on their issue, but they could also call Medford because it could be adjudicated potentially out of the Medford office. So things like that can happen. It's about 80-20, 20% people coming in and calling the overall 800 number, 80% are calling those local numbers.
Have you looked at the service that AT&T offers in terms of a little switch? If someone calls in and there's a local call, called the 800 number switches to the local number rather than routing it over the 800 service?
I don't know. I have you heard?
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly are interested in taking advantage of any savings opportunities. And,
absolutely.
We basically work with DAS telecommunications in arranging communications architecture, and we would take this question to them and ask for their support in arranging a good solution for us.
I'm trying to track down. We've gotten some numbers in terms of the total 800 bills. And
we're one of
a significant number of interstate 800 charges, which doesn't even account for the number of minutes that we've. I'm trying to figure out exactly who's calling into the state and why, and why are we paying for those inbound calls if we don't have to.
Right, we have numbers, the dollars, we have the average minutes and the average dollars for those, and we could provide those. We don't know how many, you know, people per se, but we do know the minutes.
Have you done an assessment from internal dialing the 800 number rather than dialing the office number? In terms of, so if you have someone in the Medford office and wanting to get to the central office, rather than calling the central office number, is calling the 800 number versus calling on the state network. So it routes out, we could charge 14 cents a minute versus, because they've got it programmed in a speed dial or something. Have you done any assessments sort of on network?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of that kind of analysis that's been done in our agency on the use of those calls. We certainly are interested in any economies that we could come up with, and we'd be happy to pursue that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that that was a big problem, because the adjudications are more often, they want it to be done locally, in the local labor market, because they know the people, or they've come into that office. So generally they call
employment division staff calling the 800 number to get to the main office rather than calling direct.
Well, our own staff.
Yes.
I see.
Because
otherwise
it would route out to the 800 versus routing on the internal network, which is tremendously cheaper than.
Yeah, I can ask that question. I do not know that one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one thing that we do to encourage people to have local and direct access to the field offices is on our public websites, we publish names, maps, numbers of contact people at each of the field offices. And that information is maintained directly by the field office staff so that it's always current and relevant. And those are local numbers, giving them direct access to the people in the program areas they're in.
Thank you.
On page 9, you can see a chart of the staffing levels. We have 73 IT staff, and there's an asterisk there that you can see, because we have 9 positions. Those are the numbers that actually have the, is it an I, that are shown in our classifications that have some kind of technology requirement for their jobs, but 9 of those are in our research section. They tend to be more content as well as design people. These would be like our Oregon Labor Market Information Systems. These people all, since I used to be the research director, came out. They have a research background, and they also have an IT background. And they actually work in the research section rather than the IT shop. But we wanted to give you the full number if you looked at the I's within the agency. And that's about a 1 to 20 ratio with that, those numbers included.
Where are the research people, though, show up on? I see you have the asterisk and the 9,
uh-huh.
But how are they broken up based upon how you have your pie chart broken up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, the majority of those research IT people are in the application development with the client server web solutions. That's primarily the service they provide within the agency and to the public. For example, our OLMIS website, which I hope you've all had a chance to look at, is published and maintained with that group, and they are the content managers and experts in that area.
That system is required by federal grants to the states, and it is covered by a federal grant, and they tend to be more in the research areas or the program areas across the state.
I just had a follow-up question. It just seems your ratio is high compared to other agencies we've had in front of us, especially with someone with fairly stable systems. I'm wondering how you account for that. It looks like you have 50 people. I know you have 9 that are doing your research things, but your application development on your mainframe side and your client server application piece is over 50 people. It's 50 people. The ratio seems awfully high to me in terms of maintaining and managing your system, and since half of your $22 million IT budget is in personnel, I need to understand how you account for that. You know, revenue was in, and they had, I don't know, 1 to 100, I think, is what their ratios ended up being, and I'm wondering how you justify
such high ratios compared to other state departments?
Well, we're terribly...
I know you're from ODOT, and ODOT has about the same ratio, but... I'm wondering how we deal with that issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I worked 11 years at Department of Revenue. They are not as distributed as we are, that's one thing. We have 47 field offices, and that is a very big difference. They also don't work in collaboration with other state agencies, in which we host a lot of links, as well as work with those other agencies, like the local Title I-B, Workforce Investment Act agencies, et cetera. Now, they do work with counties and some of those, so I don't want to undercut that one. But our service to our customers are quite a bit different. They actually process claims usually, as we know, one time a year when you file your income tax, and I don't want to undercut that because I work there and that's very hard. But at the same time, we process benefits on a weekly basis. So 200 and some thousand people are processing their work through us on a weekly basis. And they don't, to my knowledge, have the interactive voice response required to do those kinds of things. So we have different applications than they do. They don't have kiosks. As a matter of fact, I think we may be one of the only state agencies that do have kiosks, and yet 300 and some thousand people use those kiosks. So we tend to be more of a blend of technology within our agency than many of the agencies. That may be it. Come before you. I don't know all of the ones, but compared to the one you're talking about, there is quite a bit of difference.
I guess my question is, you have fairly stable applications. What are your 50 applications designed? I'm trying to understand. I mean, that's more of a development arm rather than a maintenance arm. I understand you interact with other agencies. I understand you do some of those things, and you're going to need to change your applications from time to time. But my question is, you know, and I know you have a lot of input, but these are IT people. These aren't data processing people, and that's what I'm trying to get my arms around is why such a large development staff and why, you know, just generally why.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, it would be interesting to compare the different types of services, just following on Director Crosley's comments, the different types of services in relation to the staffing ratios. I think you could characterize the services that we deliver through technology as typically point-of-sale type transactions, and typically those do require more support. You're right, our systems are stable. We don't have people being called up in the middle of the night to put out fires, but nonetheless, there is a high degree of interaction with our customer base, with our all of our stakeholders in delivering these services, so that I believe a ratio such as ours might, in fact, be relatively typical in a high point-of-sale transaction-based type environment, such as we offer with. We're not just publishing data passively on our websites, for example. Those are secured transactions that need to be monitored carefully and maintained carefully, which is true as you echo through the entire environment.
Let me ask the question another way. Why can't you contract out for your applications development when the need arises and have less development staff full-time on a state government payroll? What happens if we cut out 10% of your development staff and allow that money to sit so you can hire applications people when the need calls for it, if you have stable system?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Patridge, we actually have used outside staff as well as inside staff. Generally, we look at where the best way to get those things done. About 75 to 80% of our staff are maintenance, and that's not something little. And I don't know the words, because I don't know what you've heard from the other agencies to draw your conclusions. But I do know that if you actually looked at the complexity, when we talk about stable, we mean that we're not taking on a new project that we're having to redo like every 3 to 4 years. But all of our systems, or the majority of them anyway, have all been rewritten time and time again over the last 10 years. So it's not just that they're stable and we're not changing them. We do have to keep them current, And there are, almost every legislative session, we come in with something. For example, when we get to our packages, we have a, it's a BART system, a benefit system, that we look for fraud to see, again, you know, whether a person has filed and are reporting all of their income. That one was last done, I think, about 3 to 4 years ago, and there's changes and enhancements that have to be made because other people are changing their systems as well. So they are stable in that they're not going down a lot, and we're not, you know, rewriting everything. But
let me ask this question. Mm-hmm. Let me ask it this way. Do you have a work plan for these 50 people? I mean, is there any major legislation in the hopper which is going to require significant system changes this time? I mean, if there are no changes, what are 50 people going to be doing?
Mr. Chair, we'll be talking in a few minutes about some of the proposed initiatives that we have going forward. And we would be more than happy to provide you with a description of all of the typical kinds of activities that are what we typically call maintenance activities involved, that describing that in some detail so that you could see when we process the $2 million wage records every quarter and all the reconciliation and adjustments that need to be made with that and processing that goes on. We certainly do struggle with the question of when new development projects come in, to what extent do you bring in contracted resources to assist with the development. It's a terrific topic and a subject of a lot of discussion generally. We have in the past taken a mentoring model to that so that a contracted resource sit shoulder to shoulder with our person, hoping for some skills transition so that we're able to maintain the solution going into the future. The other key component is that a majority of our people actually have come out of the field and have work in the program areas that they're now the technical support people for. We wish to encourage that, and we feel that this group of people they bring such creativity, such an understanding of our mission and our way of delivering service, that they're the right group of people to help bring creative solutions to the different problems that that we encounter.
Yeah. If the problems don't change, what are 50 people going to do? And I mean, I appreciate there's a base level of maintenance, you know, and you said, well, you want to talk to us about what you want to go do.
Which is fairly minimal, though.
If we say no, that, you know, if no initiatives, what are the 50 people going to do?
Our initiatives allow us to, that we're proposing, allow us to embrace a lot of the government direction that to continue to deliver an heightened level of service and direct access to people. We have a 2- and 6-year plan that identifies a variety of opportunities with technology implications moving forward, and I believe some of that has been discussed in other venues here with you, but
we consider maintenance. That's what he wants to know.
Sorry?
What do we consider maintenance? That's what he wants to know.
We would consider many of the new federal reporting requirements that might come out for a new report as an example of a maintenance activity. We receive Department of Labor bulletins that require new data and new reporting mechanisms, for example. Those things will continue to be ongoing, and we will do that and need to do that.
We do have a chart, though, that shows the people that are assigned to each one of the programs. And Kurt talked about 77 legacy systems, but those make up of the thousands of programs that people work on inside of that. And, for example, the ones that work on the research section, right now we're signing our contract with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and each year they have new requirements for the data that they will serve. That means that we have to reprogram that data in order to give them the information that they want with Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Is that
I guess I'm trying to build how we're going to how we look at this, and to look at a maintenance, and to look at kind of a maintenance of effort department with this many people doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially looking at other state agencies who I think have, I think DHS probably has as complex a group as you do, or pretty close. I mean, I'd like to know if we had to build it from a base budget based upon your IT staff, if we were to cut 10% or 20% out of your IT personnel-based budget, what kind of ramifications those would.
Well, why don't we come back on that, because I think that that might be a better...
And maybe do it in 5% increments. I mean, does it mean they wait another day or two? I mean, I don't know what the effects are.
Right.
But it seems like a lot to me. You know, if you're able to retackle rewriting 4,000 of your 6,000 lines of code with this 50-person budget, or with this 50 people on your development side, and there's nothing that's that big this time, what I don't know what those people are going to do during this next biennium, and I need to know from kind of a base budget how we're going to build that back.
We can bring that back to you.
Okay,
send it
great.
Back to you. I can tell that there's not an understanding what Kurt's saying with the maintenance, and I'm not sure exactly how to say it yet, but I will be able to get that information for you.
Okay. What's their average salary? What's the salary range for these 50 people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, typically the highest range of our staff are run between IS 4 to IS 7.
That means not a lot to me, so.
I'm struggling also because I'm not remembering the exact dollar amount that corresponds there. So if I could, I'd like to be able to come back to you with that information.
And the benefits, too, if it's okay.
Certainly.
Okay, the IT budget on page 10, you can see that the personal services are around $10 million, capital outlay, maintenance, the training, the items that you're talking about for a total of $22.5 million. Some of that very small amount of general fund, we do have the child care budget. Federal funds are from the U.S. Department of Labor, which are employer taxes for the unemployment and employment service, and other funds are primarily contracts from other state agencies or supplemental administrative funds. Hearings panel, those would be funds from the other state agencies, and READ Act for those of you who don't know what that is funding that we also get from the federal government, but when it comes to us, it has a characteristic of other funds. And then there is some from a fraud control fund that is used for collecting fraud that can only be used for those purposes.
Representative Patrick?
I have two questions on your IT budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. First, your dial-up and kiosk telecom piece. I'm just wondering how the kiosk, is this all kiosk? I don't know how you break out the difference between dial-up and kiosk. Can you explain that to me, and then maybe that'll get my next question.
Representative Hill, Chairman Hill, Representative Patrick, we have a dial-up modem for some of our staff to call into the office to connect to our network for telecommunity remote access. That is about budgeted at about $36,000. The majority of the dial-up and kiosk telecom are the charges for the lines into the kiosk themselves.
Just as a follow-up. I mean, I've seen your kiosks, but I mean, technology has changed substantially since. I mean, you've had kiosks for what, 10 years, maybe 7 or 8 years?
93, we got them.
The technology's changed very substantially between now and then. Have you looked at moving towards something that's maybe more of a piece, that's PC that's hooked up to a high speed line, so you can save some of these costs as opposed to the.
We have, and actually, I'm glad you asked that question. We in our replacement, we call it a replacement for a kiosk strategy, would be to make them internet connected, because right now they're not, and can't be. And there is a, I was just talking to our budget and management analyst, that there is a grant that we're looking at, and if it looks like it would be allowable for that type of technology, we would be coming back and asking for that.
But in this $976,000, that's just the telco lines for the kiosk?
That's right.
Wow. Okay. For the 150 kiosks that we have.
That's 300,000 people that use that, yes. I'm sorry.
What kind of telecom lines connect these kiosks?
Mr. Chair, we're bringing T1 lines, frame relay lines into the sites directly.
They have T1 lines.
So you're like national into the kiosks?
I'm sorry, I misspoke. DSL lines using frame relay into the site.
So you're going DSL to the kiosk on a wide area network? Are you going to internet right now? You're updating the kiosk essentially. I don't know what the technology is in these kiosks. Is it just a terminal and it's all centrally located in the back, and then you've got the connectivity, or are you switching out, switching locally on the kiosk and you've got a dedicated line going out there?
The latter. Mm-hmm. We have the bulk of the programs, the content at the site. We have a variety of dynamic data that is pushed out.
Including pictures where if you are sight impaired, you can hear. There's also a person that speaks in Spanish. It is touchscreen rather than keyboard, although you can use the keyboard, but with, people with disabilities tend to, they are ADA approved because they're at the right height for a wheelchair, for example. But yes, it is data going out to the site.
Representative Hill and Representative Patrick, members of the committee, I'm also glad that the question was raised about modifications to the infrastructure in the future. In addition to the comments Director Crosley made, we also are looking at the possibility of wireless communication. There's a variety of things that might be possible with that platform, and we would be interested in investigating those.
How many of these kiosks do we have?
We have a little over 150. And they're in places like Fred Meyer stores, they're in libraries, they are in...
So spending almost $1 million mm-hmm. on 150 kiosks,
mm-hmm.
we're serving how many?
300 and some thousand people.
So, I mean, how do you judge 300,000 people?
If we keep the count on it.
It's 300,000 accesses, or...
There's a lot of little kids who walk up to them.
I'm just curious.
Me too.
I did it.
I did. I'm guilty.
I'm looking for a better pain.
You go in, I've been into the city library here, and people are standing in line and printing off jobs, and they can also update their claim on that as well. So people do use them, and yes, some people play with them.
So how do you count a use?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we actually try to distinguish in our usage count between somebody that comes up individually and touches the machine and somebody that moves through the menu in the selection of a search for a specific service. And so we count the successive transactions.
Mr. Chair, as I was in Lloyd Center, I think,
mm-hmm.
one in there, I think I was playing with them a little bit, mm-hmm. and, but I obviously didn't follow through. That would that have counted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, if you went down, I believe, two levels into a query tab, it would have counted, yes.
So if you looked at jobs, for example, it's about 70% of people who use them do go to the jobs information. Then that would be counted.
What is the proximity of these kiosks to an office?
Five of them are in college, 16 are in libraries, 10 are in city halls, 19 are in grocery stores. We have them One at the Mexican Consulate, a Dairy Queen in Benita, because that's the only meeting place for that one. Grants Pass Visitor Center, they're all over.
I'm just curious. What my question is for $1 million, you could put someone in a car and then go replace a CD, you know, on periodic basis.
Well, their purpose was to be available when we weren't there.
Well, I understand that. Yeah. I'm talking about the data. I don't know how much data you're sticking out on these things in terms of update. That seems a huge amount of money on telecommunications charges, you know, just to be pushing data out on a periodic basis. You know, how much data are you swapping out on the kiosk each time you update?
There's, Mr. Chair, there members of the committee, the exact volume of the data and the gigabyte size, I don't have it at my fingertips, but we push out job postings and a variety of other on a frequent basis.
Is that once a week, once a day, twice a day, every hour, 2 hours?
Every 2 hours.
We have a set of our data that needs to be, in order for the kiosk to be meaningful to the constituent, the data needs to be current and relevant, and so we've taken that as a strategic position that we would like to make those updates current and frequent.
Many of the jobs are self-refer, so the employers want them to come direct, and so it will tell them how to get to that job or to see a local field office if they need to be referred through the local office.
I guess I'm curious how far you really can go with that. I mean, if I was really serious and I was looking for a job and so forth, could I finally get a list of jobs?
Yes, you can print them out.
Print it out and a list of jobs.
And then you take them to the jobs, correct?
Okay, there's nothing I plug into with my name and address.
Mr. Chair and Senator Deck, you can do that to update your claim. And you can do that to field office.
At this
kiosk,
I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You can do self-service.
I just have a question. What kind of savings do you anticipate that you might get if you just go to a pure internet piece with your kiosk?
We're looking at that.
Okay.
Yeah. We have.
If we were to ask you to. I'd be interested to get some numbers if we were to unschedule part of that and at least ask you to come to us, have looked at that, even if you don't get your grant or not, so that we can make some decisions. Can you provide Lori with some of that? I'd like to make sure that you guys answer that question at least even, and I understand we still need to keep going,
right.
You know, but I'd like to get something so we can make some recommendation on unscheduling a portion of that so you can come back and report to the way everyone's on the same page.
We look every session at whether we should keep and invest in that, and people begged us to not discontinue them in the local communities, because they're in smaller communities.
No, I think they're great. I think they provide a good service, but I think the costs are just extremely high in this, and the technology's changed.
Exactly.
To me, I guess it would seem that, you know, if you've got 12 in libraries, you say, that you could just make a grant to the library to have internet access and provide them the access that you have on the internet.
And most of them have that, but they're...
Other than a kiosk. I mean, just sort of...
It's the dedication of the, you know, you have to sign up, and they, right, and so there's...
You put a PC there instead of the kiosk.
And in some places we are doing that as well, but, yes.
And what other portion, can you identify the other portion? This is just the telecom portion. There must be some other components in the base budget that relates to the kiosk.
Well, let's see, Tracy. My budget manager.
Yeah, well, he's kind of answered your question, and you might have answered this when I was sticking out of the room. Do you have a grant, so you have other funds coming into the kiosk, or is that $10 million?
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, we were talking about there is a grant that we're looking at right now of applying to replace the internet with an internet type of kiosk. The actual kiosk that we bought, the legislature approved that, and we use COP, Certificates of Participation,
for the research. And the $1 million takes care of everything.
I
970.
That's what Tracy just came to ask, answer, because the question that we got, what was included in that dial-up and kiosk telecommunication cost that was in the IT budget? And Kurt responded that it's the line charges, the kiosk line, and the dial-up. Those are the two amounts. It's 36,000 approximately for the dial-up line, 939,000 for the kiosk line charges.
For the record, my name is Tracy Loudon. I'm the budget manager for the Empire County. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's approximately $150,000 that the department also has in personal services costs that are rolled up in the upper item. It is a staff person or persons who provide support to this. There are miscellaneous costs for putting paper into the machine for the printers to come out and just some of those maintenance. Also in the maintenance line item, we do have maintenance on the kiosks, and so there's a little bit that's rolled into there as the kiosks have aged. There are costs associated with maintenance agreements. But this is the primary cost for the kiosk at this time.
You had also, when you talk about the dial-up side of this kiosk, telephone line, I know that you've got 800 numbers coming into your dial-up server, dial-up router, dial-up connection. Are we paying 800 dial-up into the network for staff?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in some cases, yes. The application for that is staff who are traveling, who are out of the area, and who are not in an located and dialing in from a location that has access to one of our local field office dial-up servers.
Have you looked at the differential on having staff use a state calling card on the state network rather than dialing an 800 number in terms of where you find the calling card rate, calling basically a long-distance number on a state calling card rather than calling an 800 number at 14 cents a minute? I think the calling card is much less than that.
I know many of our staff do have, I mean, I have one, for example, and I don't ever call. I don't even know what the 1-800 numbers are. Well, some of them would have them, but I don't know how many.
$36,000 seems to be an awful lot for dial-up charges.
Okay, now, are you looking at a different?
You said it was $36,000 out of this?
Well, out of the kiosk and dial-up, it's around $37,000 for the dial-up.
That's a lot of, I'm assuming that is 800 charges or... If it's telco charges, I mean, I could calculate out, I mean, how many lines do you have coming into this?
Mr. Chair, I'm not exactly sure how many lines we have coming in, and I would be more than happy to research that and find out exactly what is the source of those charges and give you a profile of the type of use that that really represents.
And just so I am clear, source of funds is employment tax, or the pays for all this?
The majority of it.
And so a reduction of these would be reflected in terms of rates that go down for employers? And
No.
Maybe eventually.
No.
Well, ever?
No. The administrative costs come from a different grant. There are two types of employer taxes that are paid. The administration costs come from the Internal Revenue Service type that come back to the department for running the administration of the agency. So the majority of it is that type, and that doesn't have anything to do with Oregon employer tax. That tax is set by the federal government and would not be impacted by this.
Well, we can spend with abandon then.
No, we don't have enough. Seriously, we do not have enough. We don't even get the share that employers pay in this state, back to this state. And I would hope to think that you do not think that we're spending with
the bank. No, you could find some other uses then for the $37,000 rather than dollars.
Absolutely.
For
if we could find that, that's right, yes. Any of your questions that would help us live better within our means, absolutely. We would love to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
30.
What does this general fund 0.2% pay for?
That is a reporting system that the child care division has to use for reporting child care block grants and also the complaints for child care providers.
And it has to do with this budget, this IT budget?
We have very, very small amount of general funds in our budget, but the portion that is general fund all is for the childcare.
Follow-up.
Provides support, basically.
Follow-up.
For you.
Thank you. So it's part of this professional and trade services when you talk about reports? Because you said this is for a report of childcare?
It's professional and trade services would not be what you would look at for the general fund. What we're saying is the portion of the dollars above that our general fund would be the $200,000. But it would be the system that they operate and that they maintain is a system for child care, and it basically is to keep track of numbers for child care providers. In other words, if they get complaints, and well, that's primarily it, is it's a complaint file, a registry for child care providers.
Mm-hmm. Another question. So which part of this budget is paid by this 0.2% general fund?
It's spread.
Or throughout the budget.
It'd be a little bit of personal services and a little bit of hardware, and they don't have very much information on the kiosk, but they do have some information on the kiosk, so it's spread.
Mm-hmm. But why is this paid by general funds? I mean, I thought it's all paid by other funds and federal funds.
Majority.
Why does it require a general fund to pay for it?
There is a portion within our budget that is for the administration of child care, that actually are the child care division staff or related to the child care division. And those dollars all come for the regulation part of the child care division comes from the general fund. And this is the portion that's attributable to the IT portion of that.
Oh.
There's about $4.1 million general fund in the child care budget, and this is an IT portion of it.
And another question. So part of this general fund goes into this IT budget.
Correct.
To assist in the reporting.
Correct.
Oh, I see.
We have to pay their fair share, per se.
So this is 0.2% of this, $1.6
billion. Ms. Chair, on page 11, or did you have a follow-up question?
We're not done yet. Okay. Don't do anything.
All right.
Professional trade services?
Yes.
Is that predominantly applications licensing? Or where are applications licensing reflected in your budget?
The professional and trade services are consulting services and mentoring services. And software, supplies and supplies and materials.
Or where the licenses?
It's where the licenses are.
So can you explain to me then what the professional and trade services are that you intend to use?
We have $785,000 is consulting services, and mentoring services is $75,000 consulting services. Do you want to talk about that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, you had asked earlier, do we make use of external resources? And indeed, there are times and occasions when we do need to bring in technical expertise to help with various situations and development projects that are necessary.
Okay, but those are undefined in the future?
We're expecting, as we're looking forward to bring in expertise around some of our Oracle development application areas in one specific project as an example of that.
So how much of that would you have budgeted for that?
Slightly over half.
I mean, it's better half than before.
I think, Mr. Chair, if you look on page 11, and because this is for the upcoming budget, you can see that under the Fraud Control Fund, they're asking for $325,000, which is in our budget request.
Oh, this is not, this includes policy option packages?
Yes, it does. And Tracy, do you have any further breakdown with you or not?
Let me ask you a question.
Sir, nothing.
Are you going to move to the packages, or will this be the reason I have a 5 o'clock meeting in the caucus? And I just was curious what.
It is 5 o'clock.
Well, I'm not rushing you. I just want to know if you're there to go on and look at your panels.
It's okay if you want.
Well, finish up the policy option package by 5:15, and we're not going to move it, but your permission. But it's 5:15, and finish up.
Page 11, we have four packages that Ms. Farley talked about it before. Package 116 has to do with a fraud control fund. There'd be a limited duration position that would be needed for creating this new fund. We would be using dollars that are in a fraud control, how do they call that? Like a fraud control fund. The position, it would be requested to begin the system, and this is one where we would use an outside consultant, or at least we look like we're going to. We would use an information system specialist to rewrite the system. We have a fraud tracking system now, but it's not working effectively, and we would need one for improving the efficiency of our fraud investigators and tracking software for our accounts that where people have fraudulently received unemployment insurance benefits. House Bill 3141, this is one where the legislature gave us limited duration positions. We did tell them that it would take us into this biennium to finish. So we only have 6 months of those positions that were authorized last session, and then those would go away because we would complete that rewrite, and I talked a little bit about 3141.
What was your total FTE?
For that package?
For IT.
We would have one, I think there were four positions.
One new
LD.
What's your FTE?
I'm sorry?
How many FTE do you have?
The 73. That was
73.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and you've got a body accounting for every one of those FTE? What's your vacancy rate throughout the?
The agency? Less than 10%. But I don't know the actual.
Have you, I guess I'm going to ask this question.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever moved personnel service dollars out to do something else with it rather than using it for paying salaries?
Sure we have. We tend to not do that very much, but yes, we have done that before.
So, yes, how many additional FTE in this?
There's one new limited duration position. There's an extension of 5 for 6 months that we had approved last session. There's a limited duration position for contracted services that would come to provide contracted services. But those usually are research-related projects. And then READ Act distribution, we have two permanent positions that are funded by federal funds now. They've replaced that with READ Act funds, so it's just replacing funding, not new positions.
So, 6?
I mean,
if you were asking for 6?
We're asking for
6.
We're asking for 5. Well, 5 for 6 months is how much?
So,
1.25 FTEs.
How much?
In 3141, there's 5 limited duration positions, but it's only for 6 months, so that's 1.25, right? FTEs. And then there would be a fraud control 1 FTE, so that's 2.25. There would be an employment services contracted position, that'd be 3.25.
And then, that would be it.
Chair Hill, and all those were limited, that first chunk was all limited duration.
Yes, they're all limited duration positions except for package 121, which are existing positions with just replacing funding.
Okay, so, given the fact then that...
So no new permanent positions.
You're not using all of your FTE for headcount today, but you've got less than 10%, so 73, so you have plenty of capacity within where you're at today, so you don't need any additional FTE.
Well, when you asked me what the vacancy ratio was, I thought you meant for the agency. I do not know it. So that was a total one. I do not know for the IT. They tend to not have as many as some of the other
people. I want to go back and ask that question in terms of, it seems to me that you have the capacity and you're not using it. And
absolutely.
You're using those dollars, and you might as well just use those FTE.
Sure. We'll look at that.
Okay.
Okay, in advancing e-government, 13, there are examples of our screens that you could see for the Oregon Labor Market Information System and Otter, the little Otter, which is an Oregon tax.
Where is and then, oh.
I'm sorry, page 13. And then we have a real job. Fair.com, where people can have a job fair over the internet, which is a pilot that we're piloting at the local level, primarily in the Portland area. On page 14, these are initiatives that we're currently undertaking. One is the Employer Marketplace Initiative. It has two projects under it, Business in Oregon Portal Project and the Skills Job Match Project. The Business in Oregon is shown on page 16. You can see the page, and the actual project is delineated on page 36, and then the skills jobs matching project. That is one where right now we match on job titles, and this would be, we got approval from the legislature last time, and this is the continuation of that particular project. The Workforce and Online Resource Kit is one we're doing with the seniors.
The 50 people we've been talking about previously, these are the things that they're doing.
They are working on these.
Can you break these down, FTE, by project?
I'm not sure you did it that way.
36. Page 36.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first, we tried to put the explanation of the project and its milestones and the benefits and also the resource requirements of each project in a group behind tab 7. Business Oregon, a portal project, for example, looking on page 36, shows an FTE utilization of approximately 1.5 FTE over 6 months, as an example. And I believe we followed that model. We intended to follow that model throughout the year.
This is a very exciting project on Business in Oregon, and I understand that we might be able to demo it sometime. But it has economic development, the Department of Administrative Service, Department of Revenue, Bureau of Labor and Industries, Secretary of State's office are all participating in that. The workforce portal is primarily with state and local workforce agencies, and it's very similar. We have a common intake form that we're designing with the workforce agencies, which is the online information referral form, and PRISM, which is an extension of our shared information system. In the child care, they're updating their licensing system project. This is one where we did have a consultant. We did have an outside build. It is very proprietary in nature and is very costly to change. So we are looking at and needing to change that licensing system. And then we have a language translation initiative. We're an agency that continuously look at to provide more and more information in other languages. The job orders, we have a lot of the text in Spanish,
But the job order information itself is so dynamic, updated every 2 hours. We haven't had found a software yet to be able to change it that is cost effective. And so we're continuing to look at that. We think we may have found something, and so that has been moved up to our initiative that we plan to move forward with if it is feasible.
When I look at these, and in my rough head here as I'm adding these up, they don't seem to add up to 78.
No, these are the new initiatives.
So under tab 7 is all the new initiatives.
Mm-hmm. The ones that
these are the ones that you were doing with the 50 people.
Well, we are working with the 50 people to do them, but they aren't all working on these projects. They're mostly working on our ongoing legacy programs. And we haven't found a good way to tell you how we're doing that maintenance piece. We will come back and hopefully be able to do that.
Okay. Let me jump back here before we end. The nearly $5 million on hardware and mainframe costs.
Mm-hmm.
4.9 on the hosted computer center charges.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not, you're paying for the operation and everything through this fee, these fees?
That's through the Department of Human
and
Services.
Are you doing your own application development with your people? And so DAS and DHS do not do any application development. They're just running the jobs for your schedule.
That's correct.
That's correct.
Package?
I'm just sort of asking so I can have some sort of comparison what your new initiatives were that you had last, during this last biennium. You did a nice breakout. You guys have done a nice breakout on your project plan.
And you'd like to see this the last time?
Well, what I'm interested in, well, I'll wait till you give me the maintenance piece. I'm struggling with that.
Right. I know, and I am sorry that I can't tell you in terms that you understand. So, but I hope to be able to do that.
Okay.
House Bill 3141 was basically the biggest thing we did. I think there were 10 positions that the agency got the use of READ Act funds to be able to do that last time. That was a major, as I said, rewrite of that system. But I will break those out for you as well.
I think if you could tell us in terms of the major initiative that you were told you to go do, you said, yeah, that was great. Give us an update in terms of, say, we completed, or we didn't complete, we're in the middle of that project in terms of and where we are moving towards completion.
Absolutely, we can do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then... some other things that we're looking at on page 15, I did talk about this earlier, but we have a remote initial claim grant that was approved by the emergency board. There's been partial funding awarded. We actually funded $900,000+, but it was not consistent with the plan that we gave them. And so we do need to look at whether or not we can proceed with the grant or whether or not we actually want to return the money, frankly. But we are looking at that, and should we move forward?
What is the issue?
We asked for an internet and a combination of telephone and internet, and they funded only one portion of it. And so we are having to look at it. They know that we are, but they did put aside $900,000+ for us. And if we choose to proceed, then we have been instructed to come back to the emergency board and the JLCIMT.
What was your initial grant request?
Tracy.
Internet.
It was around $1 million for both, and it was about half and half is the way we wanted it, and they gave us more money, but they limited to only one of the mediums that we wanted to use. And for us, we haven't found a way to cost-effectively do the telephone one because it right now looks like it's more expensive.
And who gave the grant?
The Department of Labor. And then we're also looking at imaging. In our adjudication section, that is a very paper-intensive. And frankly, in our benefits section, we have had the only imaging system that I'm aware of that has been successful in its implementation, and it was quite successful, but we right now are looking to, if we can, to proceed into some other areas that are also paper intensive.
So when you say you're looking at that, do you have dollars earmarked in your budget?
We do not. We usually go out.
You're going to go do it.
They have IT technology grants through the Department of Labor, and what we do is look to see whether that would fit our business, and then go after those grants should they come open. If they don't, then we don't move forward. And they usually are not matching grants. Text-to-language, IVR enhancement. There are systems like Job Match on interactive voice response, where at least in theory and in practice, Washington State is piloting one where you would call in over the interactive voice response, and instead of just doing your claim information, your unemployment insurance claim, you would also know that there were jobs available in that same area that you worked. They're piloting it. They seem to have had pretty good success, so we're looking to see if there might be a technology grant in that area. And then we've talked a lot about the kiosk today, where there is a grant that looks like it might be feasible. And if we wanted to proceed with that, given some of your comments, I have been told by staff that we would have to at least apply by Wednesday of next week.
For
a grant for a kiosk change and upgrade for internet.
So you're going to come and request the approval to go do that?
If Department of Administrative Services approves. We have not taken it to them. I just gave her the heads up because I just got the information about the grant.
Well, today's Wednesday. Full Ways and Means is on Friday. And Wednesday is before the next Friday. And my understand my co-chairs correctly, I think they're taking a dim view of agencies applying for grants and then coming and asking
for approval. We don't do that. So if we miss the deadline, we miss the grant. And we've done that before.
Mr. Chair, are we going to wrap up?
Yeah.
5%.
Okay.
We're coming to your house for dinner.
Who's going to cook?
Your husband.
Hot pocket, huh?
Hot pocket.
Okay. With that, any other questions anybody has that you would like? Are you satisfied on performance measures, Senator Yee, in terms of in this area? You know,
she's on the budget committee.
Oh, she is? Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. We're working on it.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Good.
Laurie and I are working on it, and Representative Petridge.
I just want to make sure that, you know, you're covered. Okay. With that, then we will close the public hearing on
5015,
and we are adjourned without objection.